good afternoon, everyone. I'm just going to begin with an introduction. Thank you all for coming here on such a dreary Tuesday afternoon. Really appreciate your support for our events. And before I begin introducing this topic and our esteemed speakers, I would be remiss if I didn't thank my colleagues and our many sponsors for this event. So firstly, thank you to the staff at GTI and our interns. Everyone's help is needed to make something like this happen. Really appreciate it. And secondly, thank you to the Seer Center for Asian Studies, and especially Richard Haddock, the program coordinator, who couldn't make it here today. He's actually on a vacation, so I'm envious of him. But without him, we couldn't have had this beautiful space. And if you don't already know, the Seeger Center for Asian Studies is a research institution and the academic home of the Asian Studies program for the Elliott School of International Affairs. Its mission is to increase the quality and broaden the scope of scholarly research and publication on Asia, promote U.S.-Asian scholarly interaction, and educate a new generation of students, scholars, analysts, and policymakers. And lastly, this panel is part of the Civil Society and Democracy series. And this is the third installment of this series, and it is partially funded by the Taiwan Foundation for Democracy. The Taiwan Foundation for Democracy is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, and it was the first National Democracy Assistance Foundation to be established in Asia. And GTI really appreciates their support for this series. So to get on to today's topic, Taiwan's energy future, I'd like to talk about something that happened last year in August 2017. I had a lot of colleagues in Taipei around that time, and I was getting these strange messages that the power had gone out in Taipei. And if you have ever been to Taiwan in August, it is definitely not the place you want to be without air conditioning. And this electric disruption caused major problems throughout the island for people in all kinds of situations. People were stuck in elevators. People who might have needed medical attention were in even more dire emergencies. And not to mention, it cast a lot of doubts over the Thai government's ability to fulfill its promises to reform Taiwan's energy sector. And it is critical for Taiwan to diversify its energy sources, both for security reasons, which we'll hear today, and for environmental reasons. It is as someone who follows the Paris Climate Accord, even though it's not a member of the UN, and it has very few natural energy resources of its own. It imports about 98% of its energy, and most of those are fossil fuels. However, Taiwan's options are limited because of the fervent opposition to nuclear power in Taiwan. Following the 2011 Fukushima disaster, public opinion in Taiwan shifted dramatically against using nuclear power, and hundreds of thousands of people went to the streets and protested over the years following that disaster against the construction of a fourth power plant, whose construction was completed, but it remains unused to this day. And President Tsai Ing-wen was elected in 2016 on the promise of making Taiwan nuclear-free by 2025. With all that in mind, Taiwan has made great strides in the offshore wind power industry, and it's now leading the way in Asia through partnerships with European countries, who see Taiwan as an entry point into the Asian offshore wind power market. So this panel is meant to discuss Taiwan's current policies in energy, both in terms of security and sustainability, the implications for the Asia region, how it fits with U.S. interests, and, of course, Taiwan's energy future. So I will introduce our speakers. These are very brief introductions. Their more comprehensive bios are on our handout and on our website, and I'm sure if you Google each of them, you will find a plethora of accomplishments that we don't even know about. So just to give a background on each speaker, Wen Yuwen, in the middle here, is a low-carbon energy and sustainability consultant at the Carbon Trust based in the U.K. She delivers and designs low-carbon strategy and implementation projects in Southeast Asia, East Asia, the U.K., and other European countries. She has particular interests in solar and wind energy, storage and grid issues, energy policy, circular economy, green finance, and the application of IT innovations for a low-carbon future. She received her Master's of Science in Environmental Policy from the University of Oxford, as well as a Master's in Science and Development Studies from the London School of Economics and Political Science. At the very end here, we have Clara Gillespie, the Senior Director of Trade, Economic, and Energy Affairs at the National Bureau of Asian Research. Her subject matter expertise focuses on shaping program and research agendas on energy security, trade and innovation policies, public health environmentalism, global geopolitical trends in the Asia-Pacific, and Clara worked in consulting, the U.S. House Committee on Science, Technology, and Space and the American Chamber of Commerce in the People's Republic of China. Claire graduated from the London School of Economics and Peking University with a dual master's in international affairs and a bachelor's of science from Georgetown University. And last but not least, to my immediate left, we have Lotta Danielson. She is the vice president of the U.S. Taiwan Business Council, and her duties include membership retention and development, research on current Taiwan policy issues, and research to identify the needs of U.S. businesses in Taiwan. She oversees all member products and services and manages the development of new value-added membership services. She also oversees all events and conferences, and she has planned the annual U.S.-Taiwan Defense Industry Conference since its inception in 2002. Lotta holds a bachelor's degree in anthropology from the Georgia State University, and during her international MBA program at the University of South Carolina, Lotta spent 19 months studying Mandarin in Taipei and Beijing. So with that, I will leave it to our speakers to tell us more, and we're actually going to start with Wenyu. We just discussed this yesterday. We're going to start with Lotta, who will give us an overview of Taiwan's energy policies and where U.S. businesses fit in with that.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much, Melissa. I really appreciate that. Thanks to DTI and their staff, and thanks to Clara and Wenyu as well for being on the panel with me today. I want to start by saying I am not an energy specialist. I do Taiwan. But Taiwan's energy has been something that we've been looking at for a long time. I actually went through and looked at our the council server, and we have research on Taiwan energy, on more renewables, less fossil fuels, going back to 1986. So it's been something that we've been paying attention to for a long time. I want to just talk a little bit about Taiwan's general energy environment. As Taiwan has developed its economy, they have also been seeing lots of increased energy consumption. And they're continuing to break records on demand. So actually, the top 3 days of demand for Taiwan has actually been within the last 3 months. So as you've said, the highest demand is one of the reasons why we had the blackout in 2017, because generating capacity has actually gone down over the years. Older coal and oil-fired plants have been retired, and of course, with the idea of having nuclear power going away, the power plants, nuclear power plants, have either been mothballed or have not completed construction. They haven't not gone into use. The spare capacity for Taiwan has been very low. In last year, there were 2% spare capacity in the summer of 2017, which means that Taiwan can't meet any surges in demand, and they can't compensate for any breakdowns, which is what happened in August of last year. Mm-hmm. Taipower has promised that the reserve margin for this year is going to be 6%. And that's obviously a huge improvement, but really 10% is what most countries are striving for, and actually 15% is what Taiwan wants to try to do. So to have reserve enough to deal with any shocks to the system. Taiwan needs the reliable supplies of power because it's critical for businesses, especially for Taiwan, because their technology industry is so powerful, and then you have semiconductor industry, would also need a really good supply. Is there enough for both industrial and residential use in Taiwan? Is it secure? Is it reliable? Are the costs of energy in Taiwan comparable to what they are in other places in Asia, in competing economies like Japan and Korea? If it's unstable power supply and if it's too costly, you get a drag not just on industry, but also on the Taiwan economy as a whole. Like Melissa mentioned, 98% of Taiwan's energy is imported, only 2% comes from indigenous sources. And the lack of indigenous energy resources is a national security issue. And this is something that we have to also consider. Does Taiwan have an adequate energy reserves in the event of any shortages? And I think Clara is going to talk a little bit more about that. I wanted to start just to talk a little bit, sort of a general brief overview of what does Taiwan's energy mix look like right now. It's interesting, I was looking to see what percentage of Taiwan's energy comes from what type of sources, and everybody seems to have different ideas about this, but the Bureau of Energy Statistics seems to suggest that 52% of Taiwan's current energy mix is from fossil fuel, which includes coal and oil. They have 5 coal-powered plants and a number of smaller diesel-fueled and oil-fueled plants. The largest is the Taichung power plant, which is actually one of the largest coal-powered plants in the whole world. Some of the older plants have been retired, like I said, but there is construction of a new coal-fired plant that's going to be in New Taipei City, and it has received EPA approval in Taiwan, but it's still a very controversial subject because Taiwan doesn't want to do coal-powered anymore. But even if this plant comes into use, it will take at least a decade for it to build, and there's no immediate relief to the power grid from it. So looking at, you know, coal sources, where does Taiwan get its coal? Well, it gets coal from Australia, from Indonesia, and from Russia, and it gets its oil from the Middle East and from Africa. And these are obviously, having these as the sources is obviously a national security issue, and therefore Taiwan has really been trying to diversify its supplies of coal and oil, with the U.S. being a good target for them. And actually yesterday, a Taiwanese refiner called Formosa Petrochemical bought their very first ever cargo of U.S. crude oil. And so they're actually moving forward on that. About 35% of Taiwan's energy mix is natural gas. They have some indigenous part of gas, but they also have to import a lot of it. And that comes into Taiwan as LNG, or liquid natural gas. And basically what you do is you cool, super cool gas till it becomes liquid, and then you use that to transport and store it. And it requires special conditions for both transportation and for storage. So sources for Taiwan's LNG is Qatar, Malaysia, Indonesia, places like that. And again, you know, Taiwan is really looking to diversify its sources. There is cheap and abundant natural gas available from Australia and from the United States. And there's actually been several preliminary deals between Taiwan companies and U.S. companies on buying LNG from the United States. We have talked about LNG at the Council for a while because buying more LNG from the U.S. would be a good way for Taiwan to decrease its trade deficit with the United States. And with the Trump administration being particularly focused on reducing trade deficits, this would be a really good way for Taiwan to do so. So the issue for Taiwan is they have capacity to receive LNG, but they need to increase that capacity. So they're building new receiving terminals. And it could also be really helpful for Taiwan to increase their LNG storage capacity. As an aside, LNG there's a new LNG terminal being built by Taipower, and this is something that our U.S. companies are looking at participating in. So companies like Bechtel, for example, are that they do these types of LNG terminals. So 8.5% right now is Taiwan's nuclear. It was until 2014 about 20% or so. They have three aging nuclear power plants all built in the 70s. And, you know, as you mentioned, the nuclear power plant number 4 was supposed to be built, and it was intended to have about 15% of Taiwan's energy needs. So it was going to meet that amount. And having it not go into service is definitely a blow to Taiwan's energy sufficiency. As you said, the DPP is committed to going away with nuclear by 2025. From a U.S. business perspective and perhaps from a Taiwan economy perspective, this might be a little bit too aggressive, but this is what Taiwan wants to do, and so that's what they're working on. And then finally, 4.5% or so is renewables. Taiwan is really focused on building their renewables. They're making progress, but it's a challenging process. Much of the current renewable energy comes from conventional hydroelectric dams, and there's really no place in Taiwan to continue to build those types of dams. So they're looking at other parts of biogas, biomass, and waste, geothermal, solar, and wind. And of course, there really isn't that much of a significant source coming from biogas in Taiwan or biomass, and there's only really pilot programs for geothermal plants. So solar and wind sources are the main things where Taiwan are focused. And I know Wenyu is going to talk a little bit more about wind and solar, but I want to just mention a couple of things. Taiwan is really well positioned to develop its solar energy mix because Taiwan has one of the best places in the world that do solar panels. So technology companies in Taiwan are very high up on the list when it comes to good producers of solar panel. And rooftop systems in Taiwan have been fairly fairly successful. Taiwan's feed-in tariffs, which is where you get a little bit of, you sell your energy back to the grid, those are very high in Taiwan, and that's a positive thing. But there's been some stalled progress in Taiwan on solar because of high installation costs, low prices of electricity, which means it's not really cost efficient to spend the money on putting in your solar panels, some outdated infrastructure, as well as some complicated regulations. So one of the examples is that for agricultural areas, if there's overlapping jurisdictions and some competing priorities that make it difficult to get access to land to build ground-based solar panel farms or whatever you call it, developments. And that is really essential for continuing to build the Taiwan solar power capabilities. So wind as well, offshore, as you mentioned, Melissa, that's a key component of the renewables. You know, if you read the Taiwan news, you have wind power projects almost every week. They're working on offshore program with places like Denmark and Germany. And it's a good market for investment in wind because there's strong government support for it. There is many clear opportunities. Again, there's the feed-in tariffs that are pretty high. And again, like Melissa said, Taiwan can serve as a portal to other offshore markets in Asia, and that's something where companies are looking at as an emerging opportunity. Now, Taiwan's government has a goal to increase their use of renewables. They have been working on this since at least 2009 when the Renewable Energy Development Act came into power. And since President Tsai took over, it's been even more of a focus. The new energy policy from the Tsai administration came into effect in early 2016, basically saying nuclear power free Taiwan by 2025, actively developing green energy, increasing the share of renewables in the Taiwan electricity generation, more natural gas, and to revise the Electricity Act for Taiwan to try to help energy transformation. And what they're really trying to do is to move the Taiwan energy mix to about 30% fossil fuels, 50% natural gas, and 20% to be renewables. This is a really ambitious goal. It's hard to see how Taiwan's going to meet it, but they're attempting to. One of the things that we're looking at the council is how do we encourage innovative solutions for energy problems in Taiwan. Taipower, which is Taiwan's largest power company, is a behemoth, but it's not really known for innovation and flexibility, and that's to put it the least. And they are losing money right now, which means that they're not spending any money on R&D, or they're not spending enough money on R&D. Taiwan can't really learn from other countries because of its political situation. There's a lack of international energy cooperation, and I believe that's something also Clara will be talking about. And then, of course, renewable energy is a little different than normal and like fossil fuel energy in that it's intermittent and it fluctuates. And so Taiwan needs to update its infrastructure in order to handle this influx of renewable energy. They have to improve their existing transmission lines, distribution networks, and make investments in grid upgrades. So how does Taiwan then, how do you meet this goal? There's a couple of things. I want to say that Taiwan needs to really consider planning an energy strategy that will deal with their future energy needs. They can improve their slow and currently opaque process for new deals, and they have to remove some red tape as well, and improve coordination among government authorities so that there's an overall broad flexibility in how Taiwan deals with the renewable energy. One thing that I've heard talked about is that the Bureau of Energy, which is Taiwan's primary government agency dealing with energy, is there too low in the hierarchy in the government. And there's a proposal to restructure the Ministry of Economic Affairs into the Ministry of Economic and Energy Affairs. And this is something that's been talked about since 2010, and I think that probably would be a good idea to get that. Another way to do it would be to increase prices in Taiwan. Taiwan is still fairly cheap for energy, and if you raise the prices, you encourage both industry and residential use to curb their power use a little bit, and to maybe invest in more efficient machinery and so on. Taiwan is a technology powerhouse, so they can use their tech prowess to upgrade the current fossil fuel plants that they have. They can help use their tech to increase and make a better way of distributed power. So, for example, there's a new smart microgrid in Penghu that was just announced, and so they're moving forward on that. And I know that Wenyu is going to talk a little bit about this, but I want to just mention a couple of indigenous resources that maybe haven't been exploited yet. And so they can look at increased use of biofuel and biomass. One pilot program is looking at Taiwan pig waste. So the pig industry is living, looking at Taiwan pig waste to use that to generate energy. Take advantage of the government's push into the circular economy. So you can look at electricity from waste, from heat and steam, from petrochemical production, for example. Taiwan is also looking at promoting smaller sort of local hydropower systems, getting regulations set up so you can do a smaller one for a local area, which I think would be a really good idea. There are pilot programs for clean energy generating facilities in remote areas of Taiwan, working with the Aboriginal communities, which is also, I think, an interesting way to move forward. And then, of course, there's tidal power, there's geothermal power, and one thing that I wanted to mention, which I just learned about, is methane hydrates. And that's basically natural gas trapped in ice, and there's a deposit to the southeast part of Taiwan of this particular resource. However, exploration might be suspended at the end of this year because of lack of funding. Whereas, for example, China is really focused on what can they do. They have deposits in the South China Sea, and they're trying to develop those. So, in closing, I wanted to say that Taiwan needs for energy are going to continue to grow. And even if they conserve the current energy that they have, and they reduce the amount of power that they need, it's still going to continue to be something that Taiwan needs to pay attention to. And we have to make sure that the energy resources are growing to meet that demand as well. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Lana, for that really detailed overview. I think it sets us up well for Wenyu's presentation. So, would you like to?
I forgot a slide.
Yes.
So hi, my name is Wenyu. Can everyone hear me okay?
There you go.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. I would like to first of all thank GTI for having me here and putting up with me for the next few days. My fellow panelists, distinguished panelists, and our partners, our sponsors, the audience, coming here on this, what Melissa calls the dreary day. I come from London. I mean, I've been working. This is like an average day for us. Actually, this is like a pleasant day for us. So I don't think it's that hard for you to get yourself here, but, thank you anyways. So I'm going to talk a little bit less on the kind of the landscape of energy policy more broadly, because I think a lot of has covered that very, very well. I'm going to touch on it a little bit, though, in order to talk about the interface between technology and policy, which is what I want to talk about today. I will also touch on energy security a little bit, but Clara will be doing most of that in her speech as well. So just to start off with, I want to show a few energy snapshots of Taiwan at the moment. Lala described this really well, but basically you can see at the bottom, the first line of numbers that you see at the bottom line, that's the indigenous sources of energy that is currently being consumed in Taiwan. That averaged to around 2% for the last 16 years. It's a very, very low amount of energy that is being produced and sourced in Taiwan. So Taiwan doesn't have the luxury of a great endowment of natural resources that would provide and generate electricity, for example, for its country. And she also mentioned that a lot of crude oil that's being imported comes from the Middle East. And this is obviously an energy security concern. In the long term, what the government is looking at and what we need to look at is in terms of how we can have increase the proportion of indigenous sources. One of the very obvious ways to do that is through renewable energy, and I'm going to touch on that later on. Another energy snapshot I just want to show here, and again, Lord has talked about this, is the reserve margin. So if you look at the top line in yellow, that's a reserve margin. And usually, the reserve margin should be above 10%. That's how much reserve you have on the grid. Statutory reserve margins set by Taiwanese government themselves want 15%, right? So I've kind of went for a compromise. I set the line at 12. At 12%, you can see that in 2015 and 2016, so this is on an annual basis, we didn't meet that reserve margin, right? If I had set that at 15%, there would be that would be the last 3 years where we didn't meet the reserve margin. And this is an issue because the government isn't meeting the goals that they set up. To be fair, it is pretty generous. They probably do not need to target that high. But this also doesn't tell the whole story because what you see here is a single dot for the entire year. So it doesn't take into account the peak electricity demand during summer. It doesn't take into account the peak hours and the peak month, right? So there's a lot of issues need to be taken into account that can't be captured in this just one single snapshot. And on the bottom line, what you see here is the value of energy imports as a percentage of Taiwan's nominal GDP. This is a pretty dramatic fluctuation. You have, at one point in 1996, somewhere around like 3%, all the way up to 15% in 2008. Right? So it fluctuates greatly with electricity prices. It puts Taiwanese government and the Taiwanese people at risk. Right now, electricity prices are being greatly subsidized, so we don't recognize how much your price could fluctuate. But that subsidy can't last forever because CPC and Thai Power are both generating high levels of debt. So there's going to be an end point to this. So what is the Taiwanese government looking at the moment? They want to have this energy switch where we kind of go from today, well, that's 2016, where we have, as you can see, 46% coal, 32% natural gas of power generation, so electricity generation. We're going to jump to complete eradication of nuclear, 50% natural gas, so dramatically increasing the power generation from natural gas, and 20% met by renewables. A lot of this coming from solar and offshore wind. So I'm going to talk about solar first of all. I'm going to talk about what the promises there are and what the obstacles are. So as I said, Taiwan has no fossil fuel resources, but we have a booming technology sector. And a lot of this knowledge and skill set could be translated, and all being translated quite easily into solar. Taiwan claims that it is currently the second largest solar cell manufacturing base in the world, only after China. This puts it at the heart of the global trade battle, for example, given Trump is trying to put tariffs on solar. So there's a lot of interesting things that's happening on a week-to-week basis when it comes to looking at what's happening in solar in Taiwan. So solar is currently the fastest growing source of energy in Taiwan. At the end of 2017, you have a 1.76 gigawatt of solar in Taiwan. What does that mean? I'll try and put this in context a little bit later on. As I mentioned, and as Lotta mentioned, Taiwan is a prominent global player in solar cell manufacturing. We have a strong industry, and the industry has been consolidated. Players are coming together and merging in order to be able to compete with competitors abroad. There's a generous feed-in tariff, and there's opportunities for future investment as well, because Taiwan in general is seen as a pretty transparent and friendly place to do business. So there's opportunities for foreign investors to come in and greatly increase the amount of resources that can be dedicated into, for example, innovation or research and development. So this is all very promising. On the right, you see an irradiation map, which basically means, well, how much of the sun's energy can we capture? If you look at Taiwan, it might not look that great if you're comparing it to India, for example, or if you're comparing it to Pakistan, for example. But if you compare Taiwan to the 1,500-kilometer radius around it, then there is that little tiny bit of southwest Taiwan that looks really, really good. And that's the Sun Belt. And the closest thing you get around Taiwan is the Luzon Island in the Philippines. It's much better than the neighboring bands in China, for example. So this great promise, if we are able to capture the land within the Sun Belt, which is, broadly speaking, south of the Daxia Sea River, all the way down to the southern tip of Taiwan, but on the western coast. There's a problem with that, however. I'm going to start with the second bullet point, which is land availability. Roughly, and there's a lot of disagreement about this, but roughly two-thirds of Taiwan's land is completely unusable. It's mountainous, it's steep, people don't live there. So if you look at Taiwan's snapshot at night, most of the light comes from the western coast, because that's where the cities are, that's where people live. You can't live in mountains, we can't put solar panels there, it's not going to work. So automatically, you cut out this big amount of land in Taiwan, which is basically not utilizable for anything. And what's left over needs to be distributed between urban planning, agriculture, and then renewable energy is already going to take a backseat to that. So that's why, for a very interesting reason, unlike many other countries, utility-scale ground-mounted solar in Taiwan is happening much later than rooftop, because it's much easier, in some sense, to put it on rooftop than to argue and engage with other agencies who have a conflicting interest and want to save that land, for example, for agriculture. So there is a lot of bureaucratic red tape. I think the Chinese government recognizes and they're doing everything they can to improve this, but the land availability is a real problem. In addition to that, because land is owned in much smaller parcels, if you do want to have a ground mounted project, like Japan or like Indonesia or like Philippines, you don't just talk to one landlord. Most often, you may have to talk to 500 landlords. Mm-hmm. 500 landlords doesn't mean it's 500 times more difficult. It's exponentially more difficult if you think of it from like a game theoretic perspective, because you have to get everyone on board, right? And they're all bargaining against each other. So the ability to actually build ground-mounted utility-scale solar farms is very difficult. There are some promising ways to get around that. I'll come to it later. Transmission infrastructure, most of the energy is used in the north. It's solar in the south. We need transmission infrastructure to be strengthened. Solar rooftop came first, so there's already a level of saturation that we see in the solar rooftop market. That means you might not be able to push it more that much. In a utopic world that I live in, I think every house should be covered in solar. But in the real world, Taiwan compared to the rest of the world, a lot of the solar rooftops are already there, right? So there's a pretty saturated market. And then lastly, typhoon. I don't think we have to talk about this that much, but I actually had a difficult time coming back to London this summer because I was being chased out of Taiwan by a typhoon that was coming right after me. It was really scary. So if you are financing solar panels, you have to consider the technology and its ability to deal with this. You might not be able to get insurance, for example. So there's a lot of financing problems that are specific to this region of the world. So what are the promising areas? First of all, floating solar. There's a lot of land in Taiwan that I consider unusable land for other things. Maybe it's been flooded, or maybe sinking land because of over-irrigation or overuse of ground source water. So there's a lot of promises with floating solar. People might have issues with you putting solar panels on an area that is designated to be a farm. They might not care about ponds, right? So there's a lot of promise with floating solar. What I have here, just I did it for fun, was I created a map where the center is where we are right now. And I created a radius roughly to show what Taiwan's largest current floating solar project is going to look like. So that area goes all the way from around, I can't read the name of that station, something west.
Farragut.
That. And all the way down to Constitution Gardens, right? So this radius, that area roughly equals to the amount of water that Taiwan's current floating solar project is going to cover. And they can do that in a way they can't do it on land, because they do not have to go through this political negotiation. So that's very promising. The technology itself isn't that much more difficult either. It's already there. The more you develop it, the more you deploy it, the cheaper it becomes. Policy design and implementation, there's a lot to do there. I can't go into that in too much detail. Public buildings, governments can lead the way by putting solar on their own rooftop of their own buildings. That sends a strong signal to the market as to what they want to achieve. Clients, Google, for example, has a data center in Taiwan, and they want their data centers around the world to be 100% renewable energy powered. Often the easiest way to do that is through solar contracts. So international companies with bases in Taiwan can play a big part in giving Taiwanese governments and Taiwanese businesses an incentive to develop solar. Export opportunities. So the irradiation map I showed you, a lot of that solar technology could be easily exported to Southeast Asia, for example, which is Taiwan's export priority right now. Innovation opportunities. Taiwan is well-placed with this high level of educated engineers in the country. So there's a lot that can be done for Taiwan. That's solar. I'm going to talk also very briefly about offshore wind. I realize this is a bit of a whirlwind. But you may have seen a lot of commentary in the last year or so, a lot of hype about how Taiwan is going to be the next battlefront for offshore wind. And then I went back to Taiwan, there was this guy holding a Financial Times article going, look, the Financial Times expert agreed that Taiwan is not appropriate for offshore wind. That's not what the article said at all anyways. But it was frankly ridiculous. It was very polarizing. There's a lot of opportunities there. There's obviously a lot of challenges, but the discussion isn't really being had in a nuanced way. So let's look at offshore wind. This is currently a plan. This is everything that's been settled so far, up until 2025. Let me briefly explain what happened. So earlier this year, the Chinese government said, you know what, we thought we're going to have 3 gigawatt of offshore wind by 2025. Cross it out. We want 5.5 gigawatt, almost doubling it. They just decided they're going to change their mind because you got to be ambitious. You got to be ambitious when you want to be ambitious. So they said they want to get to 5.5 gigawatt. They separated it into two processes. Their first process is we're going to give anyone who competes in the first process a certain amount of money, a certain amount of feeding tariff. So everyone comes in with what they think is the best project. They need to show that they're utilizing Taiwan's economy somehow. They're helping to develop local supply chains, or they're hiring a lot of people. And on the basis of the quality of these projects, they then select a certain number of projects who are given the capacity in order to develop the offshore wind project. That's the first. That's what we call the first phase. So people who come in the first phase all get an amazingly generous feeding tariff. Now there's a second phase. And what the second phase essentially was is people come in and compete on the basis of price. So they come in and they say, we are able to generate electricity at, for example, $2 per kilowatt hour, or whatever it is. And the government will go purely on price and go, you can give me the cheaper electricity, I'll pay you that, and you get this capacity. So it's a mixture of two things. It sounds quite logical. It does make sense because Taiwan's very new and very ambitious to, first of all, secure something. You might be paying away a lot of money, but then they have a second part where you can maybe be saving a lot of money because you're making people compete on basically what we call competitive auctions. And from these two, this is what you get. And what you see is the name of the developers. As you can see, most of them are not Taiwanese. So the way they would have won this contract is by trying to demonstrate that this will benefit Taiwan somehow, either by claiming that they will use Taiwanese manufacturers or suppliers or create a lot of Taiwanese jobs. So this is the first phase. In colors, so not in gray, in the colors are the developers that won the first phase. The takeaway point from this is to notice that, again, a lot of this is foreign. So this is a good thing in the sense that there is a lot of trust in the Taiwanese offshore wind market and the Taiwanese government that's currently being displayed by foreign developers. So that's a good thing. In grays are the projects that didn't go through in the first round. So they're the ones that didn't get a lot of this very generous feeding tariff. So the auction phase, which I mentioned, is completely based on price. You can tell, I'm going to go back on my slide. So from the gray, the left over, some of them got selected for the auction. So not many, just 4 projects, right? And both of them are international. So Ørsted from Denmark and Northern Power, which is, I think, based in Canada. But generally, again, foreign. So there's a lot of space here for Taiwanese government to think about how much are we going to get out of this in terms of creating jobs and of creating a supply chain, so creating products that maybe, for example, can potentially export to other countries in the region that want to develop offshore wind. There's Japan, there's South Korea very, very much nearby. So there's a lot more industrial policy thinking that needs to go into this beyond just setting targets and giving away capacity to developers. So what are the obstacles and opportunities? The Taiwanese Strait is actually incredibly attractive for offshore wind. So that area between China and Taiwan, if you were to look at the current universal database, what we call a 4C offshore wind database, and look at the top, I think, 22 sites with the highest wind speed. And high wind speed is good, because the higher the wind speed, the more electricity you generate in a certain amount of time. Right? So if you look at the top 22 sites in the world with the highest wind speed that are currently not being exploited, 14 of them are in the Taiwan Strait. And I think around 12 of them are in what we call Taiwanese waters. Let's not get too political. So, good thing for Taiwan, good thing for China too. So the Taiwan Strait has a lot of opportunity for offshore wind. Now, one of the issues with that is they might be a bit too far from shore. Currently, the predominant form of offshore wind is fixed to the seabed. So you basically drill down, you somehow fix your foundations to the seabed. That's what we normally, when we talk about offshore wind, we're talking about fixed offshore wind. Now, you might be slightly using a parallel. Solar has gone from ground-mounted fixed to floating solar. Oil platform has gone from offshore fixed platform to floating platform. And there's a similar evolution that's happening with offshore wind, where we are starting to see new technologies come out of what we call floating technologies. So they're basically more to the seabed instead of fixed to the seabed. And what this means, it allows you to go further away from shore to access higher wind speed and to go to deeper depth. So if Taiwan's able to get a head start on, for example, floating offshore wind technology, it's really going to help them become a leader. It's really going to help them tap into this abundant wind potential in the Taiwan Strait. There's currently also a political issue here, because the other country in the region that's currently developing a lot of offshore wind is China. But China is not allowed to play in Taiwan. And China's supplies are not allowed to play in Taiwan. So there's a question here about whether or not that makes sense. Does it make sense for Taiwan to protect the industries, or should Taiwan be dealing with China on this aspect? Because after all, they are another leader in the region. So there's something potentially there to be gained. Generous feeding tariff is encouraging foreign companies and developers to come in. As I mentioned, floating offshore wind would be a perfect technology for Taiwan to take advantage of its abundant wind potential. Typhoon and earthquake is proving a challenge, because when these foreign developers come in, they're not facing the same problems in Norway and Denmark with regards to typhoons and earthquakes. So they have to greatly rethink how they approach their technology, but also things like risk management. So this is also proving to be a new challenge. We're seeing like a rush of foreign developers coming in, and now they have to really get down to the details about how they're going to deal with, for example, the meteorological problem or the geotechnical risk. Uncertainty over power liberalization, the way that Taiwanese power is currently being dominated by Thai power, is quite foreign to a lot of these organizations, these companies. Regional opportunities, if Taiwan builds a base, it is something they can use to in order to export expertise to Japan and South Korea, which is also rapidly looking into developing offshore wind. Environmental lobbyists is always going to remain a challenge to Taiwan's offshore wind sector because they're concerned about the impact that these foundations will have on marine mammals and fish. So just to wrap up, a quick conclusion of like some other sectors you want to look at if you're interested in renewable energy in Taiwan. First of all, system and storage, smart grid. For the same reason that Taiwan is very good at doing things related to solar, for example, the kind of technology base we have also allows Taiwan to look at smart grid technologies. Secondly, storage. Taiwan is also very well placed to start developing further technology to storage. I'm not going to go into that too much, but the slide here shows some of the demonstration projects that's currently being conducted by Thai Power. Transport. Taiwan is already a leader in electric scooters. You may have heard of Gogoro. They not only introduced a new technology, they introduced a new business model. So instead of charging your electric scooters at home, you can ride through the city, drop by at some public station, take out your batteries, and put in another one. So that makes it even more convenient for people to adopt this. And this service is free. As long as you have a Gogoro scooter, you can just switch your battery packs at any power point station in the city. And that makes it much more reasonable for people to take it up, and young people love it. The hydrogen scooters were further behind, but again, in terms of in comparison to the rest of the world, Taiwan is also pretty far ahead in terms of its technologies for hydrogen scooters. White scooters, a lot more scooters than cars in Taiwan. So again, this is the demonstration of the market need. Lastly, I just kind of roughly said this is the green tech bonanza. So the Chinese government is very keen to promote green technology. They have what we call the 5 Industry Plus 2 Plan. One of the industries is green energy, so one of the industries they want to focus on. They are creating this huge mega science city in the south of Taiwan. The science city will be a place to demonstrate new green technology, to become an innovation and research hub, and they're looking to hire a lot of people. So if you're interested, you know where to look. So there's a lot of money being poured into green innovation. I think the conclusion that I want to come to is, with all the things that's happening in Taiwan, there needs to be a more, first of all, more coherent discussion about what role solar and wind is going to play. Currently, we're rushing in to developing a lot of projects without necessarily consider, is this going to be a long-term economic good for Taiwan in terms of developing a supply chain? What's the ultimate goal? I think a lot of this discussion isn't being had at the moment, and a lot of the money being poured in is taxpayers' money. So there needs to be a lot more discussion about the long-term sustainability of these programs. So I would like to end on that note and welcome any questions later. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Wenyu. That was so much information, and it was all fascinating. And I just have a couple quick follow-up questions before we move on to Clara. What was the science city? I looked at the map, but I couldn't tell which city that was.
It's called the Shalom Green Energy Science City.
Okay.
With a very long acronym, SGESC, which you can't pronounce. But it's in Tainan.
Oh, Tainan.
Yeah, okay. And it's actually very well located because I think it's in close proximity to like 6 or 7 other very technology-heavy research institutions. So they obviously put a lot of thought into that. Yeah.
And my other question is, how is the public in Taiwan divided over this wind and other renewable energies in general? Is it by generation? Is it by party lines? You mentioned there's a lot of controversy.
I don't think, I'm not sure. I don't think that's my area of expertise.
Okay.
I do think it cuts across party lines.
Yeah.
I think Taiwanese people benefited from low electricity prices for too long. I think there's a social concern about electricity prices going up because of needing to integrate renewable energy.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people start from that point and not really knowing that much.
So they're just more concerned about the cost on their personal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they look at Denmark and go, well, why is the government of Denmark giving their wind developers minimal feed-in tariff, or not at all? And why is Taiwanese government giving them such a high feed-in tariff? Is that fair for us?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they are not very aware of the issues, and to be fair, there's not a lot of public discussion about the issues. The Taiwanese government, in their rush to get this done, I don't think maintained a very high level of public engagement either.
Yeah.
And I think that could be improved.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much. So I'll move on to Clara to give us some more of a security dimension of all these issues.
Great, thank you. And thank you both, Samata and Wenyu, too, for two excellent presentations. The nice thing of going third on a panel is you always get to say, I agree with all the excellent points already made. I think when I spoke to Melissa about this a little bit, too, I said I'd be a bit of the here's why this is so hard person. So hopefully I'll interject a little bit of that, but end on, if not a positive note, but a note of things that could be done or that we might think about as next steps. Because when we talk about the plan that was rolled out in 2016, I think the plan that Taiwan has undertaken is both very ambitious, getting to that zero nuclear by 2025, while also shifting to a cleaner overall mix. And it's also, at that kind of high level, a strategy that we've heard before with certain implications and outcomes to date. So, for example, it's a strategy that in some ways sounds very similar to what Germany has tried to undertake. And the outcome of that was an increase in coal consumption in the near term, as well as a rise in its emissions profile. It's a strategy that sounds very similar to what the Noda government in Japan looked to undertake, with the outcome being that the difficulty was such in terms of the available sources or the alternatives that you've seen a lot of reversals and ongoing questions about is nuclear coming back, at what level, that can challenge developments in other parts of the energy space. And it's a strategy that sounds like the current plan that the Moon government in Korea is also looking to undertake, which remains the current strategy, but as I think many of us have already heard, they're looking to back away with the revisal of their own national energy strategy this year. It's a question on people's minds. Is zero nuclear something that's accomplishable in this period? Is it just too difficult if you put it in context of the other strategies and priorities? And if so, how do you revise that? In terms of getting a baseline sense on what's possible or what we might expect, I think Mother gave a beautiful overview of both what the strategy is and where their current mix is. APERC is a think tank that I often use as my go-to for understanding trends and analysis in the region, and they've noted that under business as usual, there are a couple things that we might expect to see in Taiwan's energy mix regardless of any of these other shifts in policy or potential breakthroughs in new technology. We would expect to see switching from coal to other cleaner sources continue, both because of the availability of new sources, whether it's natural gas or renewable energy, but also just because of the cost curve that's making them more competitive alongside other considerations. We would expect to see things in increase in natural gas for any number of reasons, including, I think, as well highlighted, the question of whether this could fit into their trade strategy with the United States. And we'd also expect to see a certain amount of nuclear retirement in Taiwan regardless. So, you know, the fourth reactor aside, the other reactors they have are currently on track to age out by 2025. So in terms of the level of ambition required or what you're really articulating and saying getting to zero nuclear, some of that you could allow through the status quo and really push on the question of this fourth reactor in particular. But if we add all of those up, I think there are some real questions on the near term. APERC, in their own assessment of these trends, said, you know, Taiwan has a very ambitious plan that by 2025 they want to be well below 2005 emission levels. Based on this strategy in losing nuclear, you will not get there. You might see peak emissions, particularly in the 2040 range for certain, but you're not going to get all the way towards that ambitious cleaner strategy. They also add a very important asterisk on the level of challenges Taiwan is facing by talking about just the enormous energy infrastructure investment that will be required to sustain the operation of current plants, current grid, and other systems in place. So they give a range for what that number is, but essentially say that between 2015 and 2040, Taiwan is going to require somewhere on the level of $63 billion to $129 billion in energy infrastructure investment. And depending whether you go with the high level or low level of that number, you're looking at about 80% of that investment being needed for just the power sector. It's an enormous challenge, and I think it underscores the fact that there are enormous opportunities in renewable energy in terms of what looks like in terms of the availability of the markets, but why this is a challenge that remains difficult and ongoing. There was an article, I hope it was not the same Financial Times article that I was reading in preparation for this, that had a title something along the lines of, Taiwan is looking at its green ambitions despite its energy security fears. And that title just made me cringe for any number of reasons. One, I think, and we hit on this a little bit, when you talk about the protests that Taiwan has seen in recent years related to its energy strategies, not just nuclear, but also questions about air pollution and how to improve that quality, I think thinking of environmental security as a dimension of energy security is critical. The other thing I would hit on with that is we often use energy security still sometimes as a shorthand for or the import question. And I think the reliance on imports is very important and it's right to talk about. Sometimes we hit on it too much as a priority strategy. So talking about coal and natural gas in particular, which if not renewable energy would be ideally what makes up that mix on nuclear. Right now what we're seeing is a market where you have suppliers in the near term such as Australia, the United States, Canada, both hit on both the coal and gas, and a more expanded portfolio overall. These are overwhelmingly reliable, more secure suppliers, and that's a positive sign. I think if you look too much at indigenous supply at the exclusion of other questions, you get a strategy that sometimes can over-enforce spending priority on one sector where you have a good domestic strength in the capacity and technology, and also hits on a lot of concerns that you have for both resource availability and for environmental security, and that strategy could well be an over-reliance on nuclear. That's exactly the priority that led Japan to where they were in 2011, where an unexpected shift in the international environment as well as the domestic environment meant all of a sudden they were without what was a substantial portion of their energy mix. So thinking about self-sufficiency is critical, but I'd almost encourage more of a shifting to think about where that fits in terms of a diversification strategy. How are you buffered for both the things that you know, but also some of those things that you don't know or that could come up? Whether they're a change in markets, whether they are an unexpected disaster, or just a shift in public opinion. For how I think about these things, and you know, maybe to tee up for our discussion some of the decision points that Taiwan might look at, my favorite definition of what energy security means is A4S. Which essentially says that you want your energy strategy to be five things. You want it to be what's acceptable, available, accessible, affordable, and sustainable. And maybe just a few points on each of these and then turn to the discussion. I think in terms of what's available, we've talked about it a little bit so far, and it's a really good story, both in terms of the rising competitiveness of renewable energies and domestic alternatives, but also in terms of the international market right now, the diversity of suppliers as well as supply choices and the ceilings involved for that. One of my favorite comments on natural gas comes from Damien Ma on this topic, which is, you know, there's every reason to believe that the geopolitics of natural gas will not be as politicized as the geopolitics of oil. It's just a more diversified market. There are more alternatives. And so when we think about the security concerns involved, we have a little bit of breathing room there. But in terms of what's acceptable, I think this is going to be the real near-term challenge for Taiwan. We've talked about questions related to nuclear and the strong push that they've got to go to zero. I always ask for a little bit of caution in overtreating this one because relatively nuclear tends to not have the highest approval ratings, and that doesn't always align with the policies that are pursued or approached. I think it does call for the question of how governments closely interact with their populations and communicate what the options as well as costs are involved. That's in part because one of the areas where we haven't hit on as much with the acceptable is coal. If you are focused on air pollution, if you're focused on some of the questions of this also being an imported supply source, the question of how acceptable new coal build or additional coal utilization is really important. And the short-term answer might be it would be much more acceptable if cleaner technologies were applied to that. But then it gets to the question of how much is acceptable in terms of new costs for the public. I touched on wind and solar for this a little bit as well. I think you were spot on in your comments. I'd also add the land use does tend to be a challenging question. If you think of it as the reason to go for renewable energy is to treat it as an indigenous source rather than something that you develop or utilize through your supply chain, this can raise important questions about what that land is not being used for. And if some of that is agriculture, then you have a very strong pushback that limits what's possible in the development or just stalls it. In terms of accessible, we touched about this a little bit, but I would just say, and I think I wrote an underscore four times here, Taiwan's grid. Taiwan's grid is a huge challenge, and even just in terms of talking about what's available, I think it's a key question that they need to address for being able to bring on more wind and solar online. And spare capacity question, Lud, I would completely agree with you as well. It's a question of where they want to spend and develop their resources in these kind of decision points. Affordability, we talked about it, I think both in terms of what this means for the consumer, but also what it means for the industry. I think Taiwan faces some enormous challenges with the fact that right now it does not have a sustainable model for its power plant and or its power system, and getting to that might involve rises in prices of domestic electricity prices. And those rises might be in line more with what neighbors in the region experience now. So it might be relatively higher, but still low in comparison. I think that's an important question that will come up and press the government, but also needs to be well communicated. If your goal is to focus on the shift to a cleaner mix, but also make it possible to have this diversification strategy, there's going to be an inherent cost involved in it. Maybe finally, my last one would be sustainability, which the government has been pretty clear in articulating what that means in context. It means the largest share of energy coming from renewable sources as possible, coupled with the cleanest baseload power possible. And that, I think, is the crux of the challenge for Taiwan. This is an issue that's not just hard because these are difficult tasks, but it's also because this is an area where there are relatively limited best practices at times. We've seen a number of shifts in markets, costs coming down, but also fundamental reversals in strategies or major shifts across the region. I would argue maybe leave here is a good reason why we need to think about ways to engage with Taiwan in international organizations, not just for the benefit of Taiwan, but because the efforts that Taiwan is taking, both technology but also policy practices, are genuinely beneficial to its neighbors. Right now, Taiwan is relatively isolated in terms of the organizations it can participate in. It's involved in APEC, which is crucial for thinking about energy security in the Asia-Pacific, and it's involved in the WTO. But for the international organizations, that's really about the end of the list. And not saying that there's one organization that is better than the other, but the ability to participate in multiple helps you to think about being engaged in the scenarios or new possibilities that bubble up that might not be known yet. So, we leave it there.
Thank you so much, Claire, as well. I'm going to ask a couple questions and then open it up to the audience. The first one is, I think, more for Lotta and Claire, but how does all this affect Taiwan's relations with the U.S., if at all? How do these energy policies change the dynamic or strengthen the dynamic, and where can the U.S. help Taiwan And where can Taiwan help the U.S.?
Do you want to start? Let me just take some.
Yeah, maybe a couple thoughts.
Yeah.
In terms of how it impacts its relationship with the United States, the U.S. and Taiwan have a diverse, kind of multifaceted relationship. So this is one part, but not necessarily the be-all, end-all. I think, as Lotta hit on, the LNG question has been particularly attractive for a number of reasons, including this idea that it could be supply meets demand. There's been less discussion in that space on coal, at least as I understand it, although coal could also be a part of that space. And thinking about either a role for a sustained nuclear industry or a safe and well-managed decommissioning, the United States also has experience in that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit on a couple of good things. I think the U.S. is looking to work with Taiwan in a variety of different sectors, and energy is definitely one of them. One of the things that we've talked about is for U.S. companies to work with Taiwan companies in Southeast Asia under the new southbound policy, and I think energy is one place that you can look at that. Taiwan has already worked on in Vietnam, for example, to do... various different developments there. And I think the U.S. has a role to play there. U.S. companies are obviously looking for ways to get involved into the Taiwan push into renewable energy. And there are opportunities there for U.S. companies to work with Taiwan companies on developing the Taiwan power grid and to develop, LNG transmission terminals, to develop a variety of different projects. So it's not something that we are super focused on at the moment, but it's an opportunity for Taiwan in the future, I think, and for U.S. as well.
Wenyu, I don't know if you have an opinion on that.
Just a few thoughts. I think, first of all, the way the power grid is structured and organized and managed in the U.S. differs widely depending on where you are, and it's much more complicated. I think there's a lot of lessons learned there that can be adapted to Taiwan when Taiwan starts its genuine power liberalization process. So I think there's a lot of lessons learned that can be taken there. I think the other thing that would be beneficial for Taiwan looking towards the U.S. is the kind of grid edge technology or behavior models that is currently being adopted by some utility companies in the U.S. in order to, for example, encourage consumers not consume as much at peak hours, for example. There's a lot of also not just technology innovations on the grid edge, but also business innovation that I think Taiwan should also be looking at, especially when it needs to start to liberalize its power sector. So I think these would be two very interesting things for Taiwan to look at.
Yeah. And so my last question before I open it up is, if you could, I don't know, put on a scale of 1 to 10, how feasible is this no nuclear 2035? And is it even good for Taiwan to be no nuclear? And I'm kind of putting you guys on the spot.
I mean, I would say it's very feasible.
Yeah.
Just at what cost is the question. I mean, it could be done with a rise in emissions profile, and it could be done with a rise in more fossil fuel consumption. And so the question is zero feasible coupled with the other things in the plan? And then I think it gets more dicey on how you can manage all of those and manage the cost side of the question.
So as a Taiwanese person on this panel, and I need to be careful what I say, I think. But I think there's one thing that I would agree for sure. I think MPP-4 is dead. It's never going to come back. So earlier this month, I think on July 4th, as this country was celebrating Independence Day, Taiwan was shipping fuel rods that was originally intended for the power plant back to the U.S. And the deadlines by 2020, all that fuel rod component will be shipped away. So that power station is gone. It's never going to come back to life. I think there is probably a reasonable discussion we need to start having about when we want to retire the other three power plants and why. Because they're already there. They're already functioning, right? If this is a security environmental issue, then we need to have an honest discussion about that. I can understand the opposition to MPP-4, especially given that it was going to be, I think, 40 kilometers from the capital. That's really close.
Yeah.
So, of course, people have the right to demand that doesn't go ahead. But I think we need to have a more broader discussion about what the strategy is with regards to the other three.
Yeah, I just want to associate myself with your comments. I think from a business perspective, perhaps it's not the way forward if we're going to be spending so much money on everything else to try to sort of force this issue to happen. But it is it's something that the Taiwanese government, that the Taiwanese people are interested in doing, and I think being able to support that is something that we probably should do, even though maybe from a business perspective it's not necessarily the best thing.
Okay. Well, it's good to know that, and I'm not sure. I wonder sometimes if the, I don't want to speak for the public in Taiwan, but in their ambition to maybe reduce the environmental risk in the case of a disaster, they might have overlooked, you know, some things that you all brought up, such as the higher emissions that come with going to other sources of energy. And business issues. So now I'd like to give a few minutes, maybe 10 minutes for Q&A, if anyone has any questions in the audience. We'll take maybe 3 or 4 questions. Yeah, that one. And if you could say your name and your affiliation before your question. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Bo, Department of Commerce. I'm curious about like having 50% natural gas in portfolio. Do you think it's sustainable? Because it will, you know, it will probably lead to a lot of trade deficit for Taiwan, as you may see the case of Japan. They resume some nuclear power plants after having importing too much natural gas. And also, I'm curious about if the ambitious energy goal has cross-partisan support in Taiwan. Is there any possibility of like shift in administration will cause the revocation of these energy goals?
And we'll take a couple more questions at once. Just one in the front. Oh, sorry. Would you have?
Yes, my name is Joel Hatker, a retired government. With the typhoons, they seem to be getting worse, that are hitting China and Taiwan, you know, more often and higher intensity. And how would this affect the wind power? Would it be knocked out at 200 miles an hour? I mean, I think they might be. But maybe it would affect the solar.
And the last one.
Richard Coleman, Derek from Customs and Border Protection. If you drive toward the Dalian Airport along the coast, you see the wind farming one after another, these huge fans. Sometimes the blades are spinning, sometimes not. And they're huge, and there's just so many of them. I stopped counting, it might have been 100. What are the economics of that? Are these things even breaking even in terms of cost? And since it is intermittent, how much of that energy can be stored, and how much reliance can be put on what's already looks like it's farmed pretty extensively?
Okay, and we'll do those two questions first and see if there are any more after that. Does anyone want to jump on the LNG, the typhoons, or the wind farming?
I can start with the typhoon, maybe. So I'm not a meteorologist, but I would tend to agree with a general observation that I do think that seems to be science that suggests, that supports the evidence that things are getting worse. I think there's a lot of people that say, well, if the wind speed is really high, isn't that good for wind power? That's not how it works, because when the wind speed surpasses a certain extent, a certain limit, the operators need to shut down that turbine in order to avoid damage. This is also a warranty issue. They are being asked by the turbine manufacturer to shut it down. Otherwise, the turbine manufacturer would be liable for the damage. So there is like engineering issues around this. Now, there's ways that we can fix that. There are people looking into typhoon-proof turbines or turbines that could have a higher wind limit before being shut down. A lot of the questions also isn't about wind per se. It's never just about renewable energy. A lot of it is about storage. So in the times when it does work, you would definitely generate enough power for more than what you need at that point, but can you store it? So a lot of the question is, can Taiwan store it? No, can Taiwan generate it? If we're going to shut something down for a few hours because of a typhoon, that's fine. But if we don't have the system or the storage spread out in a grid in order to take advantage of when it's generating its peak, then we're really not solving the issue. Solar is a different question with regards to typhoons. I'm much less technically able to comment on that. But again, this is a real question. Can we just simply put solar panels on our roofs when it can be snatched away. There are some things that work to Taiwan's advantage. For example, Taiwan, unlike a lot of other countries in the region, tends to have flat rooftops, which tends to avoid some of the issues of the solar panels simply flying away or slamming down. So there are a lot of technical things to consider there, but generally speaking, Typhoon is a challenge. I think people are aware of that, but I think we need to talk about the broader system and storage question as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment a little bit on the cross-party support issue. I do think that the DPP has really been pushing this quite hard, and that there will, if there is a change in Taiwan, there is going to be some pullback probably on this push towards green energy. But I do think that the Taiwan populace as a whole do feel that this is a worthwhile endeavor for them, and that they want to try to move towards less fossil fuels and more renewables. Perhaps the goals aren't quite as ambitious under a KMT government, but both on the legislative side and on the popular side, I think there's support for this kind of move. And so I think that that's an important thing to pay attention to.
Yeah, maybe to touch on the natural gas question as well. I think you rightly hit on the question of where it fits in this idea of a diversified energy mix, because anytime I hear that kind of number, I get my anxiety. I'm like, well, there are ways that could work out, there are ways that places do this, but if the strategy is diversification and that is a dimension of security, it's worth asking. For Japan in particular, you know, one of the reasons why it saw that huge rise in deficits was its growth in energy imports, and specifically energy that was more expensive than the nuclear that it was losing at that time. And, you know, comparatively now we are in a market that has much more supply. Now we're having questions about prices going back up, maybe not as high as that kind of 2012, kind of 2014 era peak. But questions that will factor into the decision-making process.
Are there any more questions from the audience?
Sorry.
Sorry, I just realized I haven't responded.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Onshore wind. So, I see those turbines at all, as well. I think the first thing I learned joining my company and joining the offshore wind team, when I see onshore wind turbines, which is what you're talking about, they are spinning. It's just because they're so massive that you don't realize they're spinning, because the blades are moving so slowly, but they are spinning. So trust me, they're spinning. I find it hard to believe. It's like an optical illusion. The economics are actually really good. So in a lot of places around the world, the price for electricity being generated from onshore wind, for example, would be at grid parity. So it'd be good as any other electricity you pay for. I mean, obviously, to you as a retailer, you're not differentiating that, but from the grid perspective, it's good economics. They're making money back. The reason that a lot of countries, especially Taiwan, are not further pursuing offshore wind is, again, the land question. So you have to build that on land. People don't like it in there. This whole not-in-my-backyard issue, right? You have to build it away from city centers. Some people think it looks ugly. That's why offshore wind makes a lot of sense. You take away a lot of the political issues. You take away a lot of the land issues. You also sometimes, depending on the devil in the detail, you get better economics because the wind speed being higher offshore most of the time, right? So as wind passes the land, sometimes it slows down, and so often more than not, offshore wind turbines allow you to access higher wind speeds, which means you can produce more wind at low cost. You can also produce bigger and better turbines, right? They're higher, they're taller with bigger blades. Again, this is all economics that you can deploy offshore, but you can't really do that on land. So Taiwan going from land moving further offshore, I think is a great idea.
See one this way, anywhere else? No? Okay, then this will be our last question.
Henry Hector, retired governor. I wondered about the remark on feed-in tariffs. This lady in the Senate Wen indicated that China has been overly generous in feed-in tariffs, I guess, compared to Taiwan. Here, we have sort of the opposing issue where the energy companies often seek to block feed-in tariffs at the legislature level, so that this, you know, more or less really hurts the utilization of solar power here. And even then, people go ahead with it. But they want to put in their own solar units in much larger capacities. They think they can do a better job than an individual householder. Well, I wondered about the experience that you indicated with China and maybe in Taiwan on the feed-in tariff. Are people very happy with that as an individual homeowner or a company has it on the roof and maybe they have excess electricity? What can you say about this?
Probably something, maybe I miscommunicated. I didn't actually talk about China feed-in tariff at all. But the point I was making around solar and offshore wind is that within Taiwan, the solar and offshore wind feed-in tariffs are quite good. And there is a debate about whether or not these feed-in tariffs are too high. Mm-hmm. I think for some of the scenarios, it does make sense. For example, if we are trying to encourage foreign developers to come in and set up a brand new base for the offshore wind farms, there's a lot of risk that they're taking, there's a lot of unknowns. The feed-in tariffs need to be attractive in order to get them in there and get them interested. And as you can see, when it comes to competitive price auctions, later on, they went back and gave very low price bids. So the fact that you can get them in here, get them to stay by giving them a high feed-in tariff, but then also take advantage of the lower price bids that come later, that's probably a good thing. They're also going to help develop local supply chains. Now, on solar, I haven't done the research to compare the solar feed-in tariffs in Taiwan to a comparable economic comparable economy in the region, for example. So I wouldn't know if it's too high. I would say, however, there are some things that they're doing right. And for example, within solar feeding tariffs, regardless whether it's too high or not, they're giving a higher tariff to more efficient solar panels. Mm-hmm. And what I think I really like about that is a nudge towards the right kind of behavior we want to see from consumers when they start installing their own rooftop solar. You want to also nudge them towards the better product, the stuff that's going to last longer, makes more sense on the system level. So I think that also makes sense. But on a general scale, compared to other countries, I wouldn't know if it's too high.
Well, thank you everyone for coming here again, and please join me in thanking our speakers for their insights.